Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine, the PaleoMom.com. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. Okay, can we talk about, you probably haven't seen the announcement yet, but Against All Grain announced that she's pregnant. You have to go check out her Instagram feed. It was the cutest announcement post ever. I'm so super excited.
I'm doing that right now. I'm so excited for her. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome news.
She was pregnant when she was here for the DC book signing and keeping it under wraps for obvious reasons. Yeah, but I'm so excited and happy for her. And this baby's, well, I don't know if she announced if it's a boy or a girl, but
okay, anyway. That is
cutest, right?
Announcement ever.
Yeah, so there we go. There's our gossip. We haven't had gossip in a long time.
I know. What's with us? No gossip. Well, now we can so gossip about Danielle being pregnant. Okay, Danielle, you probably don't listen to our show because
you've got stuff to do.
You don't have time and you've got enough on your plate. But just in case you actually listen, congratulations. We are so happy for you and we are wishing you just everything of the very, very, very best and the most happiest, awesomest everything because you completely deserve it and more. So congratulations. That's just awesome.
Ditto.
I'm like dancing a little bit with excitement for her.
I know. I got tears in my eyes when I found out. I was so excited for her.
2 hours ago. What have I been doing for the last 2 hours? Oh, yeah. Putting my kids to bed.
Obviously not on Instagram.
Obviously not. So I'm trying to think of any other gossip I have.
How was your conference this weekend?
It was so amazing. Like, seriously, my favorite like conference I've ever tied for my favorite conference I've ever. I love all my conferences, but it was the Nutritional Therapy Association annual conference in Vancouver, Washington. And for our listeners who aren't familiar, the Nutritional Therapy Association is one of, you know, several programs that you can do to become a nutritionist. In this case, you become a nutritional therapy practitioner, but it's sort of like one of the alternative programs to becoming a registered dietitian. And of course, there's, you know, some laws in different states that are limiting what kind of practice you can have depending on your credentials. And this would definitely, you know, there's a lot of states like in Georgia where I am, you can only give nutritional advice if you're an RD. But in a little over half the states, you can actually practice with this certification or, you know, some of the others that are available. But they invited me to be one of their keynote speakers this year. And to me, like, this is a pretty amazing opportunity because I get to speak to people who are working with clients. So it's got this great, like, pay it forward kind of branching out thing happening because I'm speaking to people who are then going to potentially implement, you know, at least some of my ideas in working with, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of different clients. So it's really sort of, it's teaching the teachers in a way. And so it's just such a phenomenal audience to speak to. And I really found them incredibly enthusiastic and receptive, but also, just really thoughtful and insightful. And it was, you know, they asked really good questions, right? It wasn't the kind of questions I normally get, which is far more about sort of practical implementation, but it was like really questions that were, you know, read this aspect of what you're talking about here and how does that fit in? Or, what would you do in this case? Like it was just really interesting conversation. And then it was a room of like 500 people. So it was one of the biggest talks I've ever given in terms of audience. And I got a standing ovation, which was like, way to make me blush, everybody.
Wait a minute. I didn't see a selfie of your standing ovation.
So I've decided to be professional. And I know. It wasn't quite the right venue for the crowd selfie. So I didn't bring my phone up on the stage. Plus there was like no podium. I was like walking on a stage with a headset. It was like really TED-esque in terms of its setup. But it was really cool. And I got an hour and a half to talk, which is also a really nice length of time. And I told the organizers just how wonderful it was because it's really enough time to thoroughly introduce and develop an idea, come to some conclusions, and really not rush through the explanations so I can kind of get to the end and still have time for some questions. And it's just a really nice length of time to talk for. An hour always feels a little bit like I'm trying to cram everything into an hour. So an hour and a half was just lovely. And
just like this podcast.
Most weeks. But I am a little jet lagged. So we're gonna try and rein it in tonight if we can. But then they scheduled a half an hour for me to do a book signing immediately following my talk.
Oh, and they don't know that you hug everybody.
Right. So, well, no, I mean, I actually, sort of like stood up on a chair and announced to my line that, you know, it was a conference, right? So it's a little bit different than a book signing. I'm there all day. And so I just said, like, please, you know, save your, you know, burning questions for some other time so I can get through everybody's books as quickly as possible. But the line was so long that it still took me over two hours being really efficient. I think it was like half the conference. It was pretty amazing. It was really intense too, because I get this adrenaline rush when I speak, and I don't, you know, people who hear me speak say that I look, you know, really at ease on stage, but I actually get extremely nervous before I talk. And I get this like crazy adrenaline rush, my hands sweat, my heart beats a million times a minute, and I don't pee for like 8 hours. And so I sat down to start signing books and my hands were shaking from the adrenaline. Like, this is not really compatible with what I want to do right now. But people were like super, super enthusiastic and kind and receptive. And I just basically felt like a superstar. And it was wonderful. So, you know, at the end of the conference, I was telling the organizers, like, you're booking me for next year, right? And they were like, yep, we are. they were really pleased with, not just that the reaction of the attendees, but they were just really pleased with my talk and the content and that aspect of it as well. So, what I talked about was, I guess sort of the, how to go from the sort of history of nutritional sciences and how we've approached dietary recommendations historically to implementing and condensing what we know from a broader scope of science into nutritional recommendations. So they don't, you know, the original nutritional recommendations were really, the very first ones were really just get enough energy so you don't die of starvation. And then the next set were really micronutrient focused, which I think was really amazing, but they were too complicated. And then after that, it became macronutrient focused again, and it lost that message of nutritional value. So what I was sort of talking about was like, how do we now move in a direction where we're going to evaluate food with a more rigorous criteria and evaluate its role that it should have in our diets, looking at not just nutrients, but also looking at anti-nutrients, inflammatory compounds, gut irritants, potentially even rolling in sustainability, impact on the environment, you know, those types of things in our criteria. And then how do you pull, what kind of information do you pull together in order to start creating dietary guidelines? And for a group of nutritionists, it was a pretty, I think, on-spot topic. So it was good. I got to be geeky, you know, how I like to do that. And people loved it. So it was really great. But I'm a little bit tired. I'm a little jet lagged. I did 15.3 this morning. Jet lagged. But I had to, because I left, I flew out Thursday morning. So I left before the announcement of the CrossFit Open Games, third workout of the Open. And so it was, my choice was either find a CrossFit box in Portland and work out jet lagged on Friday, or come home and work out jet lagged today and work in my home gym in my own place with my own people. So I chose the latter, but, it was rough. It was a harder workout than it sounded. Like, I heard it and I was like, oh yeah, like I could totally, I'll get three rounds in 14 minutes. Yeah, sure. And then I started doing the wall balls. I was like, oh, okay. So my ankles are still swollen from the long flight yesterday. And I'm clearly a little bit dehydrated. And I've, you know, been, you know, not eating my normal diet for a few days. And I'm sleep deprived. And my body doesn't know what time it is. And that 9-foot line seems really high right now. And the floor seems very far away from it. So it was a lot harder than I thought. And I at the time I wasn't pleased. Like when it ended, I was like, I was really panting. I had that sort of newbie person who's never done cardio before, cardio chest burn thing, which I never get in CrossFit. And I was like, this is really just ridiculous. But I'm looking at my score on the leaderboard. I'm like, okay, I need to just like start feeling awesome. Because I am currently ranked, now granted, this is going to change overnight as the more scores come in, but I'm currently ranked 48,421 out of like 278,000 athletes. Like, that's ridiculous. I'm nobody. Like, and to be in, like, solidly in the top quartile, you know, like, this is an amazing statement of how effectively I have taken control of my health. I used to be morbidly obese and I'm in the 48,000s. I mean, even if I dropped to 70,000 overnight, because that's where I've been hanging out most of the Open. That's amazing. Like I never think of myself as being particularly fit. Like I always think of what I can't do. And, you know, that, you know, it's really hard for me to like switch that. It's sort of like this built in from being the kid who was always last in gym and, you know, then being morbidly obese and like watching my friends decide to all go for a run. And not only like, I know I can't handle a run, but they all know it so much they don't even ask me if I want to come. Right. And like that kind of sense of isolation and rejection and failure. And it's so ingrained in me that even now, you know, being a, you know, physically fit individual, let's just start using that label for me, because I've never applied that label to myself. I've had times in my life where I've been more physically active than other times where I've been, you know, obviously slug-like sedentary, but I've never thought of myself as fit. I've never thought of myself as an athlete. I've always thought of what I want to achieve and not what I have achieved. And I am flipping that around right now, because this is, you know, clearly look at these numbers. This is proof that I am doing a great job. And, I need to celebrate that.
That's what I really loved about when I was CrossFitting, and even now, like being able to see that progress in yourself and feeling really good about your accomplishments and what you have done. And
well, I really have to thank my coach, Jake Francis, for talking me into joining the Open, because I wasn't going to, because I, you know, like I really didn't see the point, and I'm not competitive. Let's rewind that a little bit. I'm super competitive, but I'm super competitive and typically with myself, not with other people. And also typically in areas of my life where I have something to prove, you know, I have goals, ambitions, right? So, you know, that sort of drives my work ethic. And, I didn't want to be competitive with physical activity because I have no ambitions to, you know, like I have no ambitions to ever compete at the, you know, in the regionals and be this, you know, world famous muscle. I'd totally be muscly. I would love that, but I don't want to be, you know, one of these, I don't want to be somebody who's training at that level and competing at that level. So he was like, no, it's like, it's about the community and it's about being part of this big thing and, you know, having a reason to maybe test your boundaries a little bit and really, you know, just kind of gauge where you are. And then next year you do it again and you see where you are. And it's, you know, it's not about competing and it's not about pushing yourself to you until you hurt yourself. It's just about this, you know, wonderful, you know, CrossFit community and being a part of it. So I listened to him and he was totally right. And Jake, thank you. Jake probably also doesn't listen to our podcast and probably also has no idea that I'm thanking him or that I'm even saying nice things about him. I'm going to have to tell him when I see him tomorrow and say, guess what? I talked about you. But yeah, it's been a really rewarding experience. That being said, I kind of think I won't be able to walk tomorrow.
Well, then you shouldn't go to CrossFit to tell Jake.
Yeah, that's true. I'll have to tell him on Wednesday.
Cool. So that was a lot of chatting and stuff. So do you have a topic you want to jump in?
Yeah, so we just have this really big collection of sort of frequently asked questions, type questions about standard paleo, about the autoimmune protocol, and we really haven't done a sort of bringing it back to basics type show in a while. So I thought, especially given that we've both been pretty busy and I've been traveling, that it might be nice to kind of take this step a little bit more general. We've had these more detailed shows lately, and I thought it'd be good to kind of take a step back and kind of answer some of these frequently asked questions and just kind of keep it sort of more general topic. We'll be a little bit all over the place today, but hopefully these are, you know, I read these questions and kind of thought like, yeah, these are questions that I get asked a lot. And I thought, that sounds like fun. Let's do that. And you said, sure, I believe was exactly what you said.
I'm pretty sure it might have been a thumbs up emoji via text message.
Better than the poop emoji. Which,
yes. Yeah, so, well, I was in the middle of a meeting and I was like, yeah. Okay. Whatever, Sarah.
I was like 2 hours later, oh good. She thinks this is a good topic because that's all I prepared. So, yeah. So let's do a little science because it's always good to do some science.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So we're doing a general show today, and it's all diet-related questions, which means I thought it would be a good idea to talk a little bit about lifestyle in this science segment, because I think that it's one of the biggest things that interfere with our ability to be successful with diet changes is lifestyle. And I shared a new study on Facebook this week that took the body of sleep literature that I've been talking about for a while and just made it seem a million times even more important. So I've been talking about sleep. It's talked about extensively in my book. I've got several blog posts about it. and talking about how important it is. So just to sort of refresh everyone's memories, when you don't get enough sleep, it causes insulin resistance, which can lead to diabetes. It causes cortisol secretion, so that can lead to things like adrenal fatigue. It affects your metabolism. It can cause weight gain. It affects your other hormones. It affects your brain. It affects your ability to digest, right? Cortisol is huge. Your brain detoxifies while you're sleeping. So the space between your brain cells actually, your cells shrink a little bit. So the space widens, and that helps flush that just the metabolic byproducts of, you know, your neurons' metabolisms, but those are toxic byproducts. It helps flush those toxins out of your brain while you're sleeping. So if you're not getting enough sleep, those toxins can build up, and that becomes inflammatory for your brain. That also leads to neurotransmitter imbalances. So that's differences in the neurotransmitters themselves, but also the receptors. And I talked a few podcasts ago about the link between sleep deprivation and dopamine in the brain, leading to the same types of patterns that we see in addiction. So sleep deprivation is permissive for the development of addiction. Not getting enough sleep stimulates the immune system and is very inflammatory. So generalized systemic inflammation is a result of inadequate sleep. And there's also aspects of the immune system that are specifically stimulated. So specifically the attacking arm of the immune system that we see overstimulated in immune diseases like asthma and allergies, but also autoimmune diseases. And the regulatory arm of the immune system, so the part of the immune system that, you know, turns inflammation off and keeps everything in check, there's a whole pile of regulatory functions that actually only happen while we're sleeping. So when you're not getting enough sleep, you're not regulating the immune system as well. And then it also affects a bunch of hormones and can actually do things like increase hunger hormones. So it increases hunger and it increases food cravings. So when you combine that with insulin resistance and cortisol secretion, you're getting in a situation that's permissive for weight gain. And we know that there's a really strong body of literature showing that sleep deprivation does dramatically increase risk of obesity, risk of diabetes. It actually increases what's caused all-cause mortality. So if you don't get enough sleep, you have a higher risk of dying, you know, getting sick and dying, getting in an accident and dying, like whatever it is, you know, your risk is higher. And there's plenty of mechanisms linking sleep deprivation with all of these different things. So what these previous studies tend to do is when you do mechanistic studies, when you're trying to actually draw the exactly what proteins, exactly what chemicals, exactly, you know, what links are happening between, you know, the different cells or the different organs in the body, those tend to be animal studies because people don't generally like to be cut open. But when you're doing a lot of these studies where you can measure an effect with an MRI, or you can measure an effect with a blood test, those are done in people. And the standard protocol is to take people and sleep deprive them for 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. And it's usually they're allowed to get between 3 and 5 hours of sleep. And then you let them sleep 8 hours, and then you measure and see if things have recovered. And so for most of these studies, they're getting, I think, an amount of sleep that most of us feel pretty crummy, right, when we get 4 or 5 hours sleep. And so you kind of go like, well, yeah, of course, things are bad when you get 4 or 5 hours sleep. It's really easy to dismiss that effect when you get 4 or 5 hours sleep. So what was really interesting about this new study, it was it's pre-publication. So it was a study that was presented at the Endocrine Society's annual meeting. And what they actually did was they looked at a sleep pattern that is not just typical, but rampant. So they actually looked at sleep debt just during the weekday, and they completely discounted what they didn't even look at what you were doing. I mean, they did, but the correlations, the statistics they were doing with was based on the work week, Monday through Friday. So irrelevant is whether or not you sleep in on the weekend and try to catch up on your sleep. And what they did was they took patients who were newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And this is a really neat patient population to study because it's kind of like being able to turn up the sensitivity on a measurement. So you can see a bigger effect for a small change, because when you're newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, that's a really, that first year after diagnosis is a really, really important time for management. So we know that people who, you know, exercise, change their diets, you know, really, you know, take that diagnosis to heart, they can actually reverse type 2 diabetes and they can end up non-diabetic, right? And perfectly healthy and normal. But people who aren't successful at implementing those changes, their insulin resistance will increase dramatically over that year. And so you get over that first year, it's such an important time following a diabetes diagnosis. So they took those patients and they randomized them into three different groups. So one group got the sort of standard care, which is really sort of the measured carbohydrate approach, dietary recommendations. One group got a physical activity intervention, so they were given a prescription for activity. And one group got both, the diet and the physical activity intervention. And then what they did was when they had these patients entered into the study, they took a sleep survey. So they had the patients record how much sleep they were getting for a week. So, you know, Monday through Sunday. And what they did was they then went, okay, so lumping these patients together, who's getting the, you know, 8 hours average sleep requirement, who's getting less, who's getting more. And they found that initially, just when people were coming in, those who had a 30-minute or less or more, sorry, weekday sleep debt. So what that means is they were getting 7.5 hours of sleep per night on average or less per week. And maybe that was one night of 6 hours, a couple nights of 8, right? Like it's just the average. They were 72% more likely to be obese at the beginning of this trial. So then what they did is they followed these participants for a year. And what they found was that as time went on, so there was no sleep intervention. They weren't told to change their sleep whatsoever. And generally, it kind of stayed the same, right? People kind of have their habits in terms of sleep. So what they found was over the course of a year that the correlation between sleep debt and their weight and their insulin resistance increased. And so by 12 months that they could actually say that for every 30 minutes of weekday sleep debt, the risk of obesity was 17% higher and the risk of insulin resistance was 39% higher. So that means that sleeping 30 minutes less per night during the work week has this dramatic of an impact on your metabolism. This probably also, you know, in terms of what we know about mechanisms with sleep and diabetes risk, we know it affects hunger, metabolism. It affects some really important hormones that are related to adiposity. It affects neurotransmitters that affect your body's sensitivity to hunger hormones and cravings, right? So there's all different kinds of mechanisms that we understand about why sleep or lack of sleep can eventually cause obesity and type 2 diabetes. But what was so fascinating about this study was how sensitive our bodies are to lack of sleep. So it's not just a question of, you know, we know an all-nighter hurts. We know it hurts when we get 5 hours sleep. But it was really a question of 7.5 hours of sleep on average is not enough, and it doesn't matter if you catch up on the weekends. And clearly, you know, they're looking at a very sensitive population. But I think that at the same time, this is really the first study that I've seen that really shows the effect of what I think most of us get in terms of sleep, right? Like most of us get almost enough. Like if we're trying to prioritize sleep, we're still, like, unless you're really getting rid of the alarm going to bed when the sun goes to bed. Like, I think most of us kind of feel like, yeah, I probably could have slept a bit more when we get up. And what the study is showing that if you're in that category, it's got a pretty profound effect on your physiology. And so when I shared this on Facebook, there was sort of this, and I think it's a very natural response of like, yeah, but how, like, I can't change that. I can't change how much sleep I get. I've got all these other things to do. And so, you know, I want us to think about that, because as a society, we get an average of 2 hours less sleep a night than we did in the mid-1960s. So in 50 years, we have given up 2 hours of sleep a night. And yes, a lot of that has to do with the other changes in our society, right? We've got a much, much a higher percentage of two-income households. We're working more than we've ever worked before in the history of mankind. We tend to live farther away from our families. So we tend to not have the, you know, village experience when we're raising our kids. There's a lot going into it, but there's also other things, right? Like, there's Facebook and there's late night television and there's, you know, meeting everybody at the bar after work every night, right? There's like a lot of different societal norms that maybe don't need to be there and maybe should be lower priorities than sleep. And so everybody's got different barriers and everybody's got a different, you know, set of pieces to the puzzle to try and fit into place. But I think it's really important for us as a society to look at this as a problem and to start figuring out what we can do to make our lives fit in with having sleep as a higher priority and figure out what we can do to, instead of sleep being the absolute lowest thing on our list, right? We'll do everything else before we go to bed, you know, make sleep higher up on that list. And I think that that's something that we really need to figure out as a society, because I think that the impact that sleep is having on our health may be greater than anything to do with our diets. And I know that's sort of sacrilege to say as a paleo diet blogger, but I really think that this is an important issue that we need to figure out.
I don't think it's sacrilege. I think that there's been, I was doing some research on sleep, not on PubMed, but just on the Google. And there's been articles on the importance of sleep going back as long as I've been paleo. And I was surprised to find how much of it there is. And the reason that I was doing the research is because how much I notice a direct correlation in not just the way that I feel, but like mental clarity and ability to not be distracted at like that 3 o'clock hour. And also weight loss when I'm sleeping. And so I think a lot of the things that you're talking about with cortisol and insulin and all that kind of stuff are just as much to play into this additional health discovery that I'm having of late as is, you know, this idea of food and stuff. And I think the only thing beneficial for me that's kind of counteracting the fact that I'm basically had sleep debt for a year is the fact that I also started strength training at that time, which does beneficial things for hormones and that kind of stuff. But as I have been working on macros and food and micronutrients and healing myself and autoimmune and natural skin and body care and, you know, everything and anything I can to remove toxins, I've also been working on getting more sleep. And it's still not the amount of sleep that I'd like to get, but I'm getting 8 hours of sleep instead of 6.5 to 7 hours. And that makes a huge difference. And in the future, I'm going to work towards 8.5 to 9 hours, because if that one extra hour makes that much difference, what would another hour make? And if you and I can make time to prioritize sleep, then everybody can. It's just a matter of, like you said, sometimes you have to sacrifice some of the other things that you have going on. Sometimes I don't work out when I really, 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 really want to work out. Because if I come home from work and I have to podcast and I have to prep a blog post or I have to do more work email or I decide to spend quality time with the boys because that's a really good recharge for me.
And kind of your responsibility as a mother.
Right? Obviously. Yes, obviously. So... you know, all of those things. And then it gets to be 8:30 or 9 o'clock. And I'm like, oh gosh, it was supposed to lift today. And sometimes I'm like, okay, I'll just go get, you know, a quick lift in just to get something done. But the problem with that is that when I do it that late at night, it keeps me up because my endorphins get going.
Yeah. Cause it's, well, it stimulates cortisol, like it, which is when cortisol is supposed to be dropping.
Yeah. So my point is, you know, I sometimes have to make that sacrifice. If I can't fit in working out earlier, then that's the thing that I enjoy the most sometimes has to be the thing that I say, well, I can't do it today because I don't have time. And sleep sacrifice isn't something that I'm willing to throw in anymore because I realize how much more negatively that's affecting my health than I did previously. And I can tell you from a personal perspective that, you know, these past few weeks I have, you know, decided not to train on certain days in order to sleep and whatever. And I've been focused on, you know, eating right and all that kind of stuff as well. But my performance in the gym has improved. Like every time I go into the gym, I'm PRing, even if I miss a day. And certainly sleep is helping that because your cells are regenerating and your body is feeling better. So it's across the board, the health benefits of prioritizing that sleep, even if you don't think that it will be worthwhile. Just, I mean, even give yourself a week and see what you can handle.
Yeah. I aim for 9 hours in bed a night.
I know you do.
Well, and part of the reason why I do that is because my sleep quality has not been fantastic. And so the way that I compensate for that is spending more time in bed. And I'm doing a lot of different things to sort of troubleshoot my sleep quality. Most of it is just related to the Hashimoto's thyroiditis flare and not having my thyroid hormone high enough yet. But that's a very, very, very long process. And it has improved by about 25% since January. So it's definitely going in the right direction. The sad thing was that giving up caffeine seemed to have had no effect. What was up with that? So I have some thinking to do. But yeah, so it's hard. And, you know, there's lots of things that interfere with sleep, and there's lots of good information on the interwebs, about, you know, how to handle some of those challenges. And some of it's just, you know, it's almost folklore, right? Sleep when the baby sleeps, right? It's like the oldest advice in the book when it comes to, you know, surviving motherhood. And yet it is so easy to, but now's my chance to do a load of laundry. And now's my chance to, you know, do this other thing, or, well, you know, watch TV or catch up on Facebook or whatever it is. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard to make sleep a priority, but it's something that we really, really need to do.
All right. We have some questions. Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So our first question is from Jane. Are there any health concerns that you know of why the soft crumbling bones used to make bone broth could not be blenderized, that's a pretty cool word, I like that, into a cream-like soup puree along with the broth for maximum nutrition? I tried it and the cream-like consistency was excellent, the flavor amazing. Both my employer and I tried the broth blenderized with the crumbling bones in it and both loved it. And we both experienced an incredible amount of energy for hours after consuming it. Thanks for any information you may have regarding this. It is greatly appreciated.
I mean, good on ya. I don't know that there's any reason why you can't do that. I mean, you and I have eaten bones, like bones. So, what do you got here?
I mean, I think it's awesome. I usually eat some of the bones when I'm making a batch just because, I don't know, they taste good. I actually really like them. And I think that finding that tasty is probably a really good statement of your body about needing the nutrients in that. I would just put out this sort of idea to think about, and that is that, you know, a bone is not a complete set of the minerals that we actually need. It's got lots and lots of amazing nutrition in it, lots of wonderful minerals that we tend to be deficient in. And there's a lot that's still in those bones that doesn't leach into the broth. So it's a great source of these minerals, of, you know, collagen proteins. There's lots of great, great stuff in those crumbly bones. But I would look out for things like, this doesn't taste as good anymore, right? Like, I think our bodies are pretty good at, generally at craving nutrient dense foods and then kind of like going off of it, right? Like all of a sudden, no, I don't really want, you know, I was eating oysters every day, but now I really don't want them, right? I think there's a lot of people who can sort of attest to those types of experiences. So I would just say, you know, it is possible, depending on the rest of the diet, to overdo some of those nutrients. So, you know, I think it's amazing. And I think that if your body's loving it and you're having tons of energy, do it. But I would just, you know, be aware of how you're feeling as you move forward. And chances are really good, if it's feeling that great, that you're dealing with some nutritional deficiencies. And so if it stops giving you that big boost, or if you start to not think it tastes so amazing, those are kind of things to watch for. And if you have any doubt, you know, micronutrient tests are pretty straightforward to be done by, you know, a functional medicine specialist or an integrative medicine specialist, a naturopath, you know, somebody like that. So if you're worried about overdoing it, then, you know, that's always also an option.
I think also for people who are trying to use that, you can add it to lots of different things. I mean, this is really weird for me to say, but like we put, for example, we buy the salmon with the skin and the bone still in it, and we blend it up and give it to our cats, but also humans could eat it. Like you can make salmon patties or something with it. A lot of people do that, and that's why I don't like sardines, because I have a texture problem. But if you, you don't just have to do that with soup. Like there's, that's why sardines are so super nutrient dense, and we talk about them all the time. So I would just say that applies to kind of bones across the board and not just bones that you've cooked in soup.
I think you're crazy that you don't like the bones. I think the best part.
Well, you can have the bones. The only time I've ever been able to eat the bones is when we had that like crunchy fried fish egg, fish head. But it was because the texture was supposed to be crunchy. Do you know what I mean? Like for me, the problem with sardines is like there's the meat part and it's mushy, and then I'm a texture person. What can I tell you?
Yeah, I like it. So I guess I'm not a texture person. Our next question is from Janessa. I'll be short and sweet. My husband and I eat paleo, me autoimmune protocol. We also do CrossFit. Any recommendations for a protein shake for recovery?
She's autoimmune. Is that what she said?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, there's no protein, unfortunately. I've looked into it extensively. So what I can tell you is my favorite additional protein right now is something called Vital Proteins. And it's like collagen. It's not like collagen. It's collagen peptides, and you can add that to other things. So one serving has 20 grams of protein, and in my egg white protein, there's, I think, 21 grams of protein per serving. So you can add Vital Proteins to your coffee in the morning, to a smoothie that you make yourself with coconut milk. You know, there are a lot of different things, and that the problem is just that the gelatin smoothies, the collagen-based smoothies, aren't full amino acid profiles, unfortunately. But there's nothing when you're AIP that you can do, because I extensively looked when I was AIP. And, you know, there's hemp protein, there's pea protein, there's whey protein, there's egg white protein. None of those are going to be AIP friendly. So the most that you can do is, you know, I would put gelatin or collagen in a mug of broth, and just eat a lot of tuna. that's kind of how I approached it and still do. I mean, I still, you'd be shocked. A can of tuna or a can of salmon is a lot of protein. And I eat one, a whole can on my salad at lunch. And it is, if I do that, like my protein's good for the day. So.
Yeah. So I think part of this, and we've talked about it before, is, you know, the best thing that you can do for recovery is really make sure that you're fueling yourself appropriately throughout the whole day. But in terms of AIP friendly proteins, there is a beef isolate and also beef plasma isolate. Beef isolate is really very, very similar to collagen in terms of its amino acids. So it tends to be very, very skewed towards glycine, proline, and glutamic acid. Beef plasma protein has a better amino acid profile. It's extremely expensive and typically comes with some sort of lecithin in it. I've seen it most recently with canola lecithin. So just, you know, being aware that that can be problematic for some people, but it might be worth experimenting with. But it is very, very expensive compared to other proteins. And insect protein powders are also an option. So something like cricket protein powder tastes really good with bananas in a shake. But also being aware that that's a very different from a protein isolate. So, you know, if you look at whey protein powder, you know, and sort of the other bodybuilding drinks, what they do is they actually take the protein and they break the protein apart into amino acids. So you're getting these like an amino acid or like a little group of two or three amino acids, but it's really, really simple, like break the protein apart into its building blocks. And so when you do that, it's much more easily digested. And that's one of the reasons why those things are good for recovery. You're not going to get that from a whole food. And especially when you do insect protein powders, and you can get like, there's not just cricket, but you can get mealworm protein powder and earthworm protein powder. Like you can really like, you can experiment with the bugs. But if you get something made with an insect with an exoskeleton, then you're getting a lot of minerals, which is great, but that exoskeleton is also made up of a type of fiber. It's the only fiber found in the animal kingdom is in insects and shellfish. And that, you know, slows down digestion. Your digestion usually is not great after a workout anyways, so then that can make it even harder. So it's a more complete protein. It's a very nutrient-dense protein, but it's again, it's sort of the same as if you were going to just have tuna afterwards.
Yeah, and it's, like you're saying, it's really difficult to digest post-workout, and it also has, at least the versions that I've seen, a pretty significant amount of fat, and fat is also going to be hard to digest and slow down the absorption of protein post-workout. So just consider who you are and what your interests are and what your goals are. I mean, for most people, you don't need to eat immediately after working out anyway. And if you ate a banana or something as a recovery food, or, you know, you made yourself a cup of broth with some vital proteins in it, like, that's going to be plenty for 99% of people. Even I don't worry about refueling post-workout immediately. I take something called BCAAs when I have a session of working out for more than 2 hours. So specifically, I usually take them on Sundays when I work out for like 3 hours. And that's a particular type of amino acid that is it's a protein that is helpful to make me feel good while I'm working out. And that I'm pretty sure would be AIP. I took it while I was on AIP.
It would depend on, I mean, so the amino acids themselves, it's just a subset of amino acids. So again, you're getting into the imbalance issue that you would have with collagen, except you're focusing on the amino acids that are specifically known to be beneficial for muscle recovery. So whether or not it's AIP would just depend on whether or not there was any other additives, or, you know, often these powders have some type of emulsifier in them to keep them, you know, to either help them blend into your drink or keep it like a nice powder and stop it from clumping. So to just, you know, read labels.
I will work with Monica to give her the exact ones that I take, but I know that my protein powder is not AIP. It's not even actually paleo. I think there's one or two ingredients in it, like soy lecithin, and it's sweetened with stevia, which I know Sarah poo-poos on. But it's the cleanest one.
I may or may not have raised my eyebrows there.
I know. But anyway, so, and then I can also, we'll link to Vital Protein and BCAAs just to check out if that's something that you want to try to add. It's, I mean, Vital Proteins are essentially very similar to Great Lakes. They're just, they have more protein. So.
Yeah, it's the same. All right. It's a collagen peptides. It's the same thing as the green Great Lakes. It's just a slightly different granule size. That's why.
Yeah, when I looked at the amino acid profile, the Vital Proteins actually had a slightly higher percentage on quite a few of the amino acids, which is why I've been using it. But for most people, again, it's just, it's not that big of a difference or that big of a deal. So
our next question is from Kelly. I often see coconut oil recommended as a miracle food. However, I have found I'm sensitive to it. I am trying to understand why. I have celiac disease, and before I was diagnosed, I was having trouble with my gallbladder and possibly pancreas. I believe that the issue was not bile insufficiency, but rather that my damaged small intestine was not signaling for the gallbladder to contract. So I was getting a lot of inflammation and a feeling of my gallbladder being backed up. I have seen a lot of improvement on paleo and autoimmune protocol in all of my autoimmune symptoms, but in adding coconut oil to my diet, I have found it seems to affect my gallbladder symptoms. I have seen some studies indicating medium-chain triglycerides do not stimulate cholecystokinin release and gallbladder contraction. However, I'm just trying to understand what's happening a little better. I know that gallbladder and pancreas issues are common with celiac, and I wonder if others have had issues adding coconut oil to their diets, especially when eating it alone in a meal without other fats.
I cannot eat any fat at all alone by itself. Like, even in coffee, I can't. I have to eat with other foods to digest. So I'll just put that on the table. I don't know that anyone with gallbladder problems should ever aim to be able to just eat a spoonful of ghee or coconut oil, which Sarah is perfectly able to do, and I am not.
I still have a gallbladder.
Yeah, so I mean, I say this because when Sarah and I were at AHS, the ghee guy that we love from Pure Indian Foods, hello, was like, here, you guys, take a spoonful of the ghee and eat it, and I'll take your picture. And I was like, no, I can't. And Sarah was like, I'll take yours.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I gave up on that. I don't know what to tell you. And I don't feel badly about it. I don't worry about it. Like, it's just, other people say that they eat spoonfuls of fat, and I'm like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. But I will say that a lot of people claim that coconut oil as a medium chain triglyceride would be really good for me. My body has not taken to coconut oil very well. I mean, it's fine if I'm using like a small amount to cook other foods, and Sarah can give her perspective on her body's response to coconut oil. But for me, I found that the best fats are ghee and lard. Lard is my body's favorite to digest. It's why I wrote a book about it. I had absolutely no problem digesting all the foods that we made and ate for Beyond Bacon, which was very, very heavy on fats. And it's because it was a kind of fat that my body doesn't have a problem with. I think everybody's different. Certainly you're describing that your gallbladder had different problems than mine have, but I can tell you that supposedly medium chain triglycerides, that the kind of fat that coconut oil is, are recommended for people with difficulty digesting and with gallbladder problems, but it's not a fat that my body responds to very well. The other one that my body likes is avocado oil. So we do avocado oil when we want a liquid, like salad dressings, and then we do lard or ghee when we're cooking anything.
So there's a lot of things going on in my head all at the same time. So the reason why people recommend medium chain triglycerides is because they can be passively absorbed across the small intestine, and they don't actually need bile in order to, so bile kind of breaks fats up into little tiny droplets and then forms this little structure along with cholesterol to help bring goblets, you know, little tiny itty bitty bits of fat into the cells. So bile is sort of necessary to start emulsifying the fats basically inside your digestive tract, and medium chain triglycerides can be sort of passively absorbed without being broken up. But coconut oil is only about 60% medium chain triglycerides, and it's a collection of different medium chain triglycerides. So I don't know for sure if certain of them are easier to bring across the cell compared to others, but that makes sense to me logically. And the other 40% of fats might be the problem, right? Not the 60%. So that 60% doesn't stimulate cholecystokinin in the same way longer chain fats do. But there is still that 40% that's going on. And as well, other macros stimulate cholecystokinin release. So that could be something that's happening. You know, there's a lot of really interesting studies showing health benefits to coconut oil, but it's not 100% roses and sunshine. So there's a few interesting studies showing that medium chain triglycerides can stimulate IgA secretion in the small intestine from the Peyer's patches, which are these areas of your gut where the immune system is particularly concentrated. And depending on what's going on, if you have IgA food sensitivities, if IgA antibodies are part of your autoimmune disease, how stimulated your gut is or your immune system is, how damaged your gut is, like that may not be helping you. So as much as there's lots of great things showing, like they can tighten up the tight junctions between epithelial cells, right? There's lots of good things about medium chain triglycerides, but that doesn't mean that everything about them is amazing. And so there are some reasons why it may not be working for people. And if it's not working for you, don't eat it.
I got nothing.
All right. So our next question is from Megan. My question is about spices coming from seeds on the AIP. I am a chai, cumin, coriander, cardamom, nutmeg, curry loving kind of girl, and known for my fermented mustard in the circle of people I know in Calgary. I'm even having a hard time letting go of peppercorns for seasoning. I know there was a section in the book about it. I think she's talking about the paleo approach. If totally new to AIP, do you really have to give up all seed-based spices can I just stick to omitting nightshade spices? As a secondary question, what about rice vinegar? I remember wine vinegar is being listed as allowed, but not rice vinegar.
Do you just want to take this?
Sure.
I mean, I can tell you what you're going to tell him with a lot more detail, which is that those would be first ones to introduce, but that you would recommend if you're truly going to go AIP, just to get rid of everything, tell yourself it's for 30 days. And then if you see improvement in your symptoms, then they can be on the short list of things to reintroduce that a lot of people are going to have success with in reintroduction. Just test your response. Yeah. I eat them.
Curry almost always has nightshades in it. So just as if we're going to talk about this list of spices that she gave us, I think it's really important for people to realize that curry powder is a blend of seasonings, and it almost always includes chili and or red pepper. So that can be a sneaky source of nightshades. I think there's two ways to approach this. So, and I think which way someone chooses has to really depend on how severe their disease is and how quickly they want to see results. So I think the most expedient way to see results is to cut out all of the problematic substances, including all the seed-based spices, and do a really strict autoimmune protocol until you see that you're feeling better. But there is an argument to be made if it's a question of, like, I'll do it if I can have seed-based spices or I won't do it at all, you know, or sometimes the question, I'll do it if I can still have my coffee, or I won't do it at all. You know, I'll do it if I can still have my chocolate. I won't do it at all. I mean, those are sort of also stage one-ish reintroduction foods. So, you know, in that case, I think it's worth trying and then just knowing that it could be holding you back. And if you don't see results, you can't blame the autoimmune protocol because you're not actually doing it. You're doing most of it. And so, you know, just knowing that if you're not healing quickly, if you're frustrated, then you're going to now have to go to a full elimination diet. And, you know, I think that how people go about it, just like some people rip off the Band-Aid and jump in with both feet, some people tackle the change in bits and pieces and go baby steps. You know, I think that has to be something that respects what works for best for you for your life. But I will emphasize that they are cut out of the autoimmune protocol for a reason. It's not just to torture people. But they do have compounds in them that can be gut irritants, that can be immune stimulators. They have anti-nutrients. Like peppercorns. Pepper is one of the highest phytoestrogen foods in our diets. And so there's things in them that can be really problematic, and they're more common food sensitivities than you would expect. Both pepper and nutmeg came up as two of my 17 food sensitivities on the recent food sensitivity panel that I did. So, so just, you know, being aware that, a small amount can be a problem. I like to draw the analogy of, you know, someone with a peanut allergy. If they are, you know, eating something that was prepared in a room where there was peanuts, that can cause them to go into anaphylaxis. Or think about how small an aspirin is and how dramatic of an effect that can have on your body. And so just thinking about, you know, those types of things can really sort of emphasize that, yes, that half teaspoon of that, you know, seasoning in your dish, you know, yes, it's a small amount. And yes, these things are by far not the most problematic foods that are eliminated on the autoimmune protocol, but it can be a problem and it can hold you back. So, you know, take that information and make the choice that's the best for you. As for rice wine vinegar, it really comes down to the fact that rice is a gluten cross reactor. There is a fairly large percentage of celiacs who are sensitive to rice, and we see that in scientific studies, and there are trace proteins in the rice vinegar. So it is cut out for that reason, but it would be an acceptable reintroduction food. Wine vinegars are not cut out because grapes are not gluten cross reactors.
Awesome. So it has been wonderful chatting with you all. I want to apologize now that it's over for the treadmill desk and shortness of breath as I was talking.
I totally didn't notice.
Really? I'm glad. Good. Because there were several points where I was talking where I felt like I was like, not because I can't breathe while I'm walking, just because it's difficult to breathe and to talk while walking. So
it's the trifecta.
Yes.
That's what it is.
Yes. So it was good for me. I had a really, really heavy training session yesterday, and my back and legs were all kinds of tight. So happy to have been very productive with you all this evening. Thank you for having patience with me.
I may have to do that tomorrow. I opted, normally I walk and or stand at the treadmill desk, but today I decided to sit on my butt during our podcast recording, and I stand by that decision. It has been wonderful.
I always stand, except for like if I'm sick or maybe if I'm jet lagged or something, but I rarely walk just because it's difficult while we're doing. Anyway, we will be back next week, I think, with some paleo Mythbusters. We've been getting amazing positive response from people on the Mythbusters series, so since Sarah won't be at a conference, gallivanting, eating all the delicious things in Portland this weekend, perhaps she can pull out some more science for another myth-busting session next week.
I suppose I can.
So, have a good one, everyone, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Have a good night. What was that?
I don't know.
Let me just do that again. Sorry, Matt. Thanks for listening. That makes so much more sense.